This is The Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. The 2016 presidential election between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton was among the closest in U.S. history. While neither candidate came close to winning a majority of votes, if Hillary Clinton had won just 78 more thousand votes in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, she'd be president right now. So how did Donald Trump squeak out his victory, and what does his slim but definitive margin of victory mean for the future of politics in America? My guest today is the co-author of the excellent new book, The Great Revolt, Inside the Populist Coalition Reshaping American Politics. The book explores and answers this very question. What does Trump's victory mean? Selena Zito is a Pittsburgh-based journalist who wrote for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review for a dozen years before being laid off in 2016. We're going to talk about that. That same year, she became a columnist for the New York Post and a contributor at CNN. And earlier this year, she published The Great Revolt with Brad Todd, a campaign consultant based in Nashville. Selena, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
You bet. So why don't you let's start by talking about your kind of forced, midlife, mid-career change, because in a lot of way that encapsulates the region that you're talking about in this book. It's basically about how Trump won because he won. He basically got the Great Lakes votes, which had been going Democratic for a while, certainly in places like Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania. You also talk about a few other states. But, tell me and tell the listeners about your unfortunate career transition.
I should backtrack just a wee bit so you understand what happened. I've been writing about this growing populism since the 2006 midterm elections when the Democrats swept the Republicans out. And I understood that if we continue to have big wave election cycles, that was an input, plus coupled with a sort of industrial technological revolution and a recession, we were heading to this point in about 10 years. Turns out I was accidentally right. In July of 2016, I drove across my home state, which is Pennsylvania, went to all 67 counties, and I calculated based on interviews and signs. And yes, I know campaign signs do not vote, but the way the campaign signs were made, they weren't bought. They were, on the sides of houses. They were on the sides of fences. I even saw a horse that had Trump painted on the side of it. I knew that something different was going on. And based on my reporting, I said, look, if Trump just gets 2,000 more votes in 10 counties in Pennsylvania that voted for Romney, but not enough. He only needed 2,000 more out of each of these counties. He was going to win Pennsylvania. It didn't matter what she did in Philadelphia. It just needed those 10 counties, and three of them were traditional Democratic counties that had voted for, this is Northampton, Erie, and Luzerne, and these had voted for Barack Obama in very strong numbers. But my gut told me something different was happening. And so, if he won Pennsylvania, that meant that North Carolina, Florida, Wisconsin, Iowa, Ohio, and Michigan and Wisconsin were gone. Why? Because Pennsylvania is 5 points more Democratic than those states. Mm-hmm.
So, how much of, what was it about the idea that there were handwritten signs for Donald Trump in your experience? Was that more of a kind of statement about Hillary Clinton or about Donald Trump in your mind? Or does it doesn't matter?
It was more about them. I think that's the part that people miss about this entire election. Donald Trump did not cause this. He was the result of it. And I think that's the nuance that people don't understand. It's not about him. It's about them. It's about their families. It's about their communities. It's that's the localism that I talk about, and I'm sure we'll get to that later.
Yeah.
So fast forward, I wrote that in July, and I basically said this election is over. Y'all just don't know it yet. Mm-hmm. I took a lot of grief for saying that, and I kept telling people this is not because I support Trump. I don't vote in elections that I cover, because I always interview all of the candidates. So it's very, for me, this is a personal choice, but for me, it's incredibly difficult for me to sit across from someone knowing I may be either voting for them or voting, you know, against them.
So,
fast forward to September. Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, fast forward to September, please.
September 19th. I took a buyout at my paper. It became evident that I needed to. And it turns out the people that didn't take the buyout got laid off anyways. That was September 19th. As I'm walking out of the newsroom, and if anybody's ever worked in a newsroom or worked in a place where you have this really strong bond, I was weeping as I walked out of the newsroom. It was a very sad moment for me. I get a text from someone within the Trump campaign saying, "Hey, Zito, you got an interview with Trump tomorrow." And all I could think of is, who am I going to write it for? I was never really someone that did a lot of freelance work, because I did so much work at the newspaper. So I called around. The New York Times turned me down. Washington Post turned me down. BuzzFeed turned me down. Finally, The Atlantic said yes. And so I sat down and I interviewed Trump before he went to speak at a Marcellus Shale coalition in my hometown of Pittsburgh. It was during that interview that I asked him what he thought of the notion that voters take him seriously, but not literally, but my profession takes him quite literally, but not seriously. The Atlantic decided to make that the headline. And from that moment on, I worked for four different news publications, writing four different stories, 7 days a week, every day until election day.
What was
money either?
Remind me. Well, that's the that's the travails of the freelancer, right, or the contract employee.
Oh my dear! Yes.
How did Trump respond to that question? About
all he said was, "Oh, that was interesting."
Yeah.
But one of the things I noticed about him during that interview is, after the interview, he walked around behind the stage talking with what you would consider the blue collar people. You know, the people that were, walking around with the carts of water or the food or the electrician. And man, he totally connected with them, and they totally connected with him. It didn't matter what their race was, what their age was. It didn't matter. That's when I really noticed he was much more comfortable with them than the rest of us.
Did you?
It was a glimpse.
Before we talk about the book itself, I mean, do you have a sense when you're with him that he is calculating, or is this? Is it just kind of intuitive to him?
That was the only other times I have interviewed him were at the White House, and I forget where the other place was. And so that was about the only time I ever saw him interact with people in terms of being associated with an interview. And I think he is a calculating and intuitive man, but I also think he's very intuitive. And I also think that his connection with people that aren't part of the sort of the elite set is very genuine. He seems incredibly comfortable with them. He's very, very comfortable with them. I'm only speculating here, but I'm a pretty decent judge of character. Mm-hmm. You can tell when people were putting on airs. He had no, there's no camera rolling. No recording rolling. There was no reason for him to put on a show. Pittsburgh.
Did you interview Hillary Clinton during this campaign season or during the two? Yeah. And what about her?
Because
this is something that I've always heard about Hillary Clinton, but I've never met her or seen her in a you know, except in a giant arena kind of setting. But I've heard that she's actually very good one-on-one. But then as the crowd gets larger, she gets more and more kind of stiff and removed. Is that your experience with her?
Yeah, I've interviewed her probably a half a dozen times over the years, maybe more. Mm-hmm. She is very comfortable when it's just you and her. As staff starts to come into the room, and or if she's in a crowd, there's almost as if there's this sort of wall that goes up. It's a shame, you know, but, you know, it's not a character flaw. It's just, yeah. You know, I think that probably having been in national politics essentially since 1992, it's a defense mechanism that I think a lot of people would probably develop over sure. that time. But one-on-one, she's incredibly comfortable. Yeah.
So she only needed one of the things that you and your co-author point out in The Great Revolt is that she only needed about 78,000 more votes. And if they had been scattered properly across Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, she would have won. Why do you think she was? But then you also point out that she was substantially less popular than Obama in those states. And Trump was more popular than previous Republicans, at least in terms of primary candidates. So why was Hillary less popular to voters in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania? And why was Trump more so, do you think?
So I think she was less popular for several reasons. First of all, it's gone undetected for a while. But, you know, I have been reporting on this also for about a decade, in that our trust, and it's on both sides of the aisle, with institutions and expertise has been waning for decades.
Sure.
And she sort of symbolized everything that had to do mm-hmm. with, you know, institutions and expertise. But, you know, there's a couple of layers of things that went wrong for her, even if she was able to jump over that hurdle. And I do believe she was able to jump over that hurdle. She did not have a message that was inclusive. The message was about her and or her journey, her resume. And people were longing to be part of something bigger than themselves. You don't get people energized with a story about yourself in that manner. And so that's why if you sort of put that side by side to Trump's message, people, you know, people who didn't understand Make America Great Again, I think missed why people liked it. I've heard people call it a dog whistle. I still don't know what that means. I've heard people call it racist. I heard people call it nostalgic. But having been in the trenches with people all across the country, that was a very aspirational, very forward moving message. It meant being part of something bigger than themselves.
Yeah. And you're part of America.
Together.
Yeah. In the book, you contrast her one of her speeches in Pennsylvania to one that Bill Clinton gave, I think, in 1992 when he was running, and he was saying things like, you know, this election isn't about me. It's about you.
Right.
You know, and this was famously when he was feeling people's pain and he was pushing the idea that there was a massive recession, which was overstated and was already in recovery, but it was all about jobs. It was the economy, stupid. Whereas Hillary talked a lot about how she wished her mother was alive to see her about to become the first woman president and to see her granddaughter. So that's the kind of difference that you're talking about. And you're essentially arguing that Trump was more like Bill Clinton than she was.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I saw so many similarities between 1992, Bill Clinton, and 2016, Donald Trump in their messaging. It was about bringing you along and we were all in this together. It didn't matter where you came from. We were all in this together and we want to go to a better place.
Now,
that message is very important.
How does that, and I'm not asking you to defend it, but to kind of explain it.
Yeah.
How does that inclusivity square with the notion that, Trump also, I mean, literally 5 minutes into announcing for president, he started going on about how Mexicans are, rapists and drug dealers, and they're not the best from Mexico. Some of them, I guess, are good people. Is that inclusivity that certainly spoke to white Republican voters and independents and white women who voted
Democrat.
For. Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, who voted white women overall voted for Donald Trump, although women overall voted for Hillary. How is that inclusivity bought at the expense of creating an outgroup, though?
I'm not sure how to perfectly answer that, that would mm-hmm. that would satisfy people that get sort of enraged about this. It goes back to the literally seriously thing. Mm-hmm. People took that as, look, he's talking about the bad guys. He's not talking about everyone that's from Mexico. He's talking about the bad guys. And that's how they took that moment. And, here's the other thing. I think under the Obama era and continuing with Hillary's message, it was a lot of talk about internationalism and globalism and, we're all part of a bigger world. And Americans for a long time have felt that you have to remember, a lot of the people in the Great Revolt and a lot of Trump voters did vote for Barack Obama, not once, but twice. While they personally liked him, they didn't particularly care for his policies. And they didn't particularly care for the notion that you had to be apologizing all of the time for America's misdeeds, as they have happened in throughout history. And so
you also mentioned, though, yeah. I mean, how much, if I may ask, at one point, you and your co-author, Brad Todd, talk about how Hillary, for instance, visited Iowa, Michigan, and Wisconsin just 7 times versus Donald Trump's 18 times. How much of that, I mean, is, and I guess it's partly the content of the message, but then also, are you there to deliver it? And if I'm remembering correctly, she did not visit Wisconsin once during the campaign, which because, she had reasons to believe that it was in the bag. But how much is just being there important?
Being there is so important. Having a presidential candidate show up in places that haven't seen one in decades is incredibly important. And that they essentially saw him as coming there and saying, hey, I want your vote, and here's why. Now, part of the problem, I think, Nick, the why people didn't understand why he was catching on with voters is part of the way that news is delivered these days. So a lot of times reporters get into a plane and they all fly together and they land at the same airport and they stay at the same Marriott and they all go together in the same, bus, and they go and sit inside the same cage. I sit in the cage too. Mm-hmm. But what happens is that when you do that, you miss understanding what's happening in a community. And when you arrive at a rally and you see some of the things that he says or the things he said at the door of the elevator, what you tend to see is just the most salacious things. And you miss all of the other economic message that was delivered. So a lot of people sat at home and saw these packages with 7 terrible things that Donald Trump said, missing the other things that he said in the entire hour. And they missed sort of the happiness and honestly, the joyfulness that you would see at a Trump rally.
Well, people talked about them. Yeah, people talked about them as kind of like, rock concerts almost, where he was doing riffs as like, instead of Freebird, he was doing a riff about Lion Hillary or, Alberta Ted Cruz or something. What were the, what's an example? I think we can come up with examples of the bad messages and the things that were, that made the evening news or the cable news programs. What was an example of an economic message that he gave that was inclusive or kind of energizing to a crowd?
He essentially said in almost every stop that he went to is, I have your back. I understand what your problem is. I see the different problems in your community, and we're going to fix this. It's not going to be perfect. It's not going to be fast, but we are all in this together. There is such power in that inclusiveness. It's a subtle yet important message that smart politicians like Bill Clinton were able to deliver, and it meant something to the people that voted for them. Ronald Reagan was also incredibly great at delivering that same message. And I think that's what Reagan and Bill Clinton and Bill Clinton of 1990s and Donald Trump all have in common. They recognized the room. They understood what the people needed and or wanted, and they delivered it.
Yeah. And it's kind of bizarre to think that a guy who was raised, you know, as a wealthy kid in Queens, as a son of a very famous or well-known and rich developer, is a billionaire and won't shut up about it, is somehow connecting with the average American. But, you know, and one of the things,
absolutely.
One of the things that we'll talk about is the survey that undergirds the book, The Great Revolt, which I think is really fascinating. And one of the things that I, you know, really commend you and your co-author for doing is both mixing, you know, kind of high or deep level political analysis with actual reporting and talking to a lot of different people and gathering data. But, you know, there's a survey of people in the kind of states that flipped for Trump and really made him president that you guys did. And there were big issues, a big four of issues that you talked about for Trump's coalitions that were based on things he kept saying during the campaign. And it was bringing back manufacturing jobs, protecting Medicare and Social Security, putting conservatives on the Supreme Court, and then building a wall with Mexico. And to that point about what people cared about, the poll results showed that, you know, it was 35% or basically a third of people were interested in the job stuff. About a third were interested in protecting Medicare and Social Security. 30% or 28% wanted to see conservatives voting put on the Supreme Court, and then only 7% seem to really give a shit about the wall with Mexico, which is
right?
But Trump is clearly has a populist appeal. And, you know, the populist, that word is in your subtitle. How are you defining Trump's populism? What's the essence and the nature of it?
I still don't know, honestly. I don't know if he's a populist, just like I don't think that Andrew Jackson was a populist. I do think both men are masters at understanding a populist moment in movement among the electoral. But a populism in the modern era definition is a sort of skepticism of all things big. So think about Wall Street bankers or Silicon Valley monopolies or big government, a big Hollywood, a big sports. You know, that's
big business, right? I mean, Trump.
Business, right,
yeah,
exactly.
Trump won't stop talking about Amazon, for instance, which is,
right.
I mean, partly Silicon Valley and it's partly Walmart on steroids. You know,
right.
But okay, so there's the bigness. And then you were also talking about how there's the attack on elites, which seems to be a signature move of populist rhetoric of saying, you know what, there's all of these fat cats, you know, who are living on Wall Street and, you know, fancy apartments like mine. There are the people, the globalists in D.C. who run nonprofits. There are the big businesses who ship jobs overseas in order to save a penny and make more money. So you have the bigness, you have the attack on the elites. And then I guess part of it is also the focus on economic issues or kind of kitchen table issues to the exclusion,
yeah.
Or I guess maybe not to the exclusion, but those are predominant over kind of social issues. Is that accurate?
Absolutely.
Do you think?
I just want to step back to the elite thing. So I think it's a nuance that people miss a lot. So it's not a resentment that people are making money, and it's not a resentment that people are being successful. It's a little different than that. It's that the people in the what we call, well, actually it comes from Walter, I'm going to forget his name, book, Coming Apart.
Charles Murray.
Thank you.
Yes.
I was going to say Walter Murray, Charles Murray. So it's about the fact that decision makers in every aspect of our life live in these sort of super zip codes, you know, where, you know, you're typically located on either side of the I-5 or I-95 corridor on either coast. Mm-hmm. And so their decisions that they make, whether it's in sports, look at the NFL, where they make the decision, they make a series of really dumb decisions regarding the national anthem. Well, where are they located? Park Avenue. They'd be better if they moved their offices to Canton, Ohio, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. In terms of understanding who their consumers are. So there's this frustration more with decisions not made that have people in the offices that maybe grew up in East Liverpool, Ohio, or Howard County, Iowa, as opposed to everyone living on Park Avenue.
And so of course, this matters. And this matters because, you know, under the American electoral system, you've got to get electoral votes all over the country. Because, you know, this is obviously Hillary handily won the popular vote, and she really ran up the score in places like California. But
New York and Illinois.
You need is one more vote than the other person to take all of the votes. So all of the electoral votes. So, you know, one of the, I think, truly genius analogies that you and Brad Todd draw in the book is that you say that Trump, that he's a nationalist, but this is not, you know, it's certainly not Adolf Hitler's or Stalin's nationalism or anything like that. It's not even FDR's. And that it's actually about localism versus globalism. Yeah. And you use the metaphor of saying that Trump's kind of localism is really like Whole Foods localism. And now, you know, Whole Foods seems to be a place where these, you know, the global rootless cosmopolites go to shop. But how how do you mean that? Like, walk us through that analogy a little bit, because it's pretty interesting stuff.
Okay. Anybody that shops at Whole Foods, and I believe other chains have also adopted this now, thanks to Whole Foods, it's really important to people to buy something that's grown really close to where they live. So what you see when you're in the produce department is almost like a geographical map of where every piece of fruit and or vegetable came from. And it becomes important to the buyer and the consumer that they buy things that were grown locally, you know, something that supports the local economy. And people are praised for that, right? That's wonderful. You know, it's farm to table, you know, eating. Like, everyone thinks that's wonderful, except when a Trump supporter wants, their sort of thrust of part of why they voted for him is making their areas, their communities, their friends, you know, and their family more, you know, having a more stable life and having better economic opportunity, they're not afforded the same dignity that people that are, you know, shopping smart for local fruits and vegetables. And I just think, they misunderstand, you know, the nationalism, you know, people think like, you know, 1930s. This is completely different, and it is very much about localism. I teach a class for Harvard where I take the students out, and they live in different parts of the country, and they just came back from Youngstown, and without me saying anything, they got it. They're like, oh, this is about the community. This is localism. This isn't nationalism. And I was really proud of them for, like, without telling them anything, but through interviews and through living in Youngstown for a week, they understood it immediately.
Yeah, so it's it's stunning. I live part time in Oxford, Ohio, a college town, but a small town near Cincinnati, and you know, it is amazing to me, even some of the people I work with who are all, you know, they're good libertarians and they like the individual and they like localism and they like decentralized everything. The assumptions that are made about people who live basically, you know, to the west of the Delaware River, I guess, and, you know, east of, you know, the 405 on the West Coast, it's often kind of breathtaking that, you know, who are these non-character non-character members of a game. They're just backdrop. One of the appeals, as I mentioned, of the book is that you did a survey of 2,000 people in various states that went for Trump, that really decided the election. Talk a little bit about that survey, and then let's talk a little bit about some of the types of voters that you guys typologize. But what was the survey, and how'd you come up with that idea? Of the survey was conducted in I believe it was August of 2016 or the summer of 2016.
2017.
Excuse me, 2017.
No, that's not your fault. There's a typo in the book.
Yes.
It was on,
I wanted to bring that up. Yes.
Yes. It was our one. Well, I think we have like three typos. And, you know, as a reporter, they just yell at me every time I open the book up. But, you know, one of the things, one of the biggest criticisms I received as a reporter reporting about Trump was that, it's just anecdotal reporting. It's not real. So we wanted to make sure that when we wrote this book, we could back it up in understanding who these really different types of archetypes of voters were and what their sentiments were. Now, I have to tell you, that was the scariest 2 weeks of my life waiting for this survey to come back, because while I understood, to me, we had come to very good conclusions after interviewing hundreds and hundreds of people, mm-hmm. that these are the archetypes that went undetected. The survey, and here's where their sentiments lie. And they're not the sentiments that people believe. You know, unfortunately, the narrative about a Trump voter is, they're white, they're uneducated, they're stupid, they're racist. And blah blah blah. I mean, it's like the most negative thing you could possibly think. I understood, and Brad understood with me, that this was not the case. It was a very different and very sort of diverse. And I don't mean diverse in terms of ethnicity. I think we all understand that the majority of his voters were white, although he didn't do much different than Romney and or McCain. And
he did slightly better with both Hispanics and blacks than Romney did. So, you know, which again, they're starting
at.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of fascinating. And I think part of that is because at least a few times during the campaign, he attempted to speak directly to certainly African-American voters when he said, and again, you can take it or leave it, but he said, you know, you've had Democrats, you know, courting you and getting your votes for decades. What have they really done for you? And then he did talk about things like school choice and kind of law and order issues, which in places like Chicago that has a heavy black population, you know, you can see he was at least addressing them in a way that I don't think Romney even bothered trying. So you talked to voters in it was five states, is that right?
Yeah. Pennsylvania, Ohio, Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, and Iowa. We surveyed 2,000 people. There were 400 from each state. This is not an easy survey to do because these are rural places. And so those you ask any pollster, they're incredibly difficult to nail down. But, you know, they were self-identified Trump supporters. And we wanted to understand if the people that we if the categories of voters, the archetypes, the seven archetypes that we determined were part of the Trump coalition. We wanted to determine if we had that right and if the sentiments that they espoused lined up with the communities in which they came from, with the states in which the counties in which they came from. We picked 10 counties in the book that voted Obama, Trump.
Right.
We eliminated any county that voted for a Republican senator in 2014.
So we won't go through all of the archetypes, but some of them are, they have interesting names. And if you could kind of color.
That's all Brad.
Okay, well, color in, like, so for instance, there's the rough rebounders are one type. Who were rough rebounders?
Rough rebounders are probably our most That and the Paralistas are probably the two most libertarian of our groups. The Brave Rounders are people who have had tragedies in their lives that have helped shape them into where they are today, whether it is multiple divorces, death in the family, loss of job, you know, medical problems, whatever the case, you know, economic problems, whatever the case may be. These people were the most or are the least religious. Only 24% of them said they attend church regularly. 30% of them voted for Barack Obama. And these were the most common voters that said that they went to a rally for Trump. They were his most enthusiastic. And when he made mistakes or, you know, said something that was off color or, you know, that made the press hair go up in flames, they were the first ones to say, you know what, I kind of could see myself doing that, not because I'm mean or this or that, but because I tend to be blunt in the way that I speak. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I found all of them to be very interesting people. Mm-hmm. Every time I met them, they had such rich, you know, stories and had gone through, you know, hell and back and a lot in their lives.
So
I enjoyed writing about that.
Well, let's go. If the Rough Rebounders were the least religious or least practicing religion, then who are the King Cyrus Christians?
Well, King Cyrus for Christians, I mean, we didn't come up with that one. That was, I think, the analogy came from, I think it was Tony Perkins. Mm-hmm. King Cyrus was the Persian king who led the Israelites back to Jerusalem so they could rebuild the city. There's not a lot in common with a Persian king and the Jewish people. And so it's that same sort of analogy that this has befuddled a lot of people. How can evangelicals line up with, you know, a three-time married, coarse,
pussy grabber type? I want to stress when you said it's Tony Perkins's phrase, you don't mean the actor from Psycho, you mean the psycho who, in my mind, who leads the Family Research Council. So it's a different Tony Perkins. But these are evangelicals essentially who say, you know what, I don't care about the guy's personal life. What I care about are his policies or his objectives.
I have to tell you, what I found that was most funny or ironic for me is that for years and years and years, you know, moderate Republicans and or Chamber of Commerce type Republicans have just been throwing their hands up in the air the day after primary and saying, why can't these evangelicals be more pragmatic with their vote? Well, this time they decided they would be. It wasn't about shared priorities. It wasn't about shared values. It became about shared priorities. Mm-hmm. They decided that this time, maybe the last time in their generation and maybe in their children's generation, that they could have a mark on who is what the Supreme Court is made up of. And that became the most important reason. You started seeing them go for him strong when he put out that list through when he works with the Federalists.
Society, right?
Jurors.
Yeah,
yeah. The Federalist Society. Who he would appoint, and that was then. You know, I mean, there were a couple stragglers he pulled over the line at the end, but for the most part, that did it. The Supreme Court was the most important thing. They believed that religious freedom was you know, at stake, and this was their last chance to sort of get their vote in.
So let's do one more, and then I want to go on to a couple other things. But there were the silent suburban moms. Where did they tend to live, and what were their issues that they cared the most about?
So shy suburban women were women who lived in, it's sort of all about economic density, right? Mm-hmm. So these are women that were typically college educated or, you know, had worked in a professional manner all of their life. But they lived in a county like Macomb County in Michigan, where you had a mixed economic diversity in that county. Yes, there were well-to-do people, but there were also, you know, people that were struggling. There were blue collar, there was poverty. And these women felt the pressure from social pressure from other women who would not think about voting for Trump, but so they kept themselves quiet. And their issues were across the board. Their issues not only were about the Supreme Court, but also about their community. This had a lot to do with localism, you know, a lot to do with watching their areas decline and people coming in every 4 years, or even local politicians saying, we're going to fix this and we're going to do that. And nothing had changed.
So now, you know, one of the things, and one of the chapters of the book towards the end is about it's titled Pragmatism Before Ideology. And you talk in the book about how, say, somebody like Rand Paul, who was more overtly libertarian and was hostile to the Republican Party in many ways that Trump was. But, you know, Trump won partly by appealing to he was a pragmatic guy. I'm going to bring back your jobs. And that also flummoxed a lot of Republicans who were like, we've got to get rid of Obamacare. And you guys point out that he said, don't worry, we're going to get rid of Obamacare, but the government's still going to be there for you and pay for things. And he pointedly said at one point, this is not, you know, I'm not running for president or the nomination of the Conservative Party. I'm running for the nomination of the Republican Party. My question to you is that to the extent that Trump is banking on, like, his appeal is, I'm going to bring jobs back to America, and I'm going to bring jobs back, particularly to parts of Western Pennsylvania or rural Wisconsin and you know, UP, the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Many of these places, their populations peaked not even in 1980 or 1990, but 1940, 1950, 1960.
Yeah.
Can he actually do that? I mean, and then what happens if he fails to?
Well, I mean, I think that remains to be seen. You do see pockets of job growth. Again, as I mentioned before, I was in Harvard. We were in Youngstown, and we visited the old sheet and tube mill where 8,000 people once worked. Now 14 mm-hmm. people work. But right down the road is a new steel plant. That does much more sort of, I'm not going to think of the word, but it's much more designer steel. Uh-huh. And they are hiring, and they're looking to fill jobs. I don't think that if your image in your head is 10,000 people working at the same place is going to happen again. No, that's never going to happen. But between peeling back a lot of the regulations and the tax reform and the tariffs, I think a combination with that opens up the ability to create new jobs. I think people, again, this is the literally seriously thing. I don't think that there was anyone that I spoke to that believed that the mills would be humming again, but they do believe that that opportunity was going to be created again, even if it was in just hiring 50 or 100 people at a place as opposed to thousands.
Let me ask you a question. And looking back at your previous writings, and as we've discussed, you've been a professional journalist for some time. Didn't you also think that Pennsylvania, for instance, Western Pennsylvania, the part of the state that you're from, you were kind of predicting that they would also go for McCain in 2008 and Romney in 2012? Can we ask, or can I ask, is this just like you've been pushing a line that a kind of Republican reaching out to blue collar voters, to people in the heartland, in the Rust Belt, really, are going to flip? You know, is that a fair question to ask, or how do you respond to something like that?
Sure. So in 2000, I think I studied this in the beginning. So 2006, when the Democrats swept in the big wave election. In the midterms, that's when I started to detect this potential that this could happen. And while I would, you know, spend a lot of time in the same places, in the same places in the midterms, but not so much in the, even for the 2008-2012, it was almost there, but neither McCain nor Romney could ever never got those those last voters, and I described them in the book, the Paralistas, right?
Mm-hmm.
The people that are not reliable voters, that need to be inspired. They make
and
up
these
about
6%
of the electorate.
Right, and these are guys or men and women who came out for Ross Perot back in the day.
Right, yeah. Right. And then pretty much never came back out again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that was the mixing kind of or the missing ingredient that Trump was able to.
That was people point to blue collar, but you know, if you look at the midterms in 2006, 2010, and 2014, it was Democrat, Republican, Republican. But if you look at those races, you saw those blue collar voters. You know, they went for those moderate voters in 2006. And when they were, you know, sort of eviscerated by 2010, mm-hmm. you know, they went Republican. But they personally liked Obama, you know. So it was sort of a combination of those blue collar voters who personally liked Obama, didn't like his policies. That's why they voted out Democrats in 2010, 2014. Mm-hmm. But also it was also those Paralistas. Mm-hmm. Those voters that, you know, would say, I think I'm going to come out. You know, I think I might vote for Romney. And in the end, on Election Day, found themselves, you know, occupied or not busy. And that was about, and it's about 6% of his vote. And that's the ones that I think actually made the difference in this election. People will point to other people, you know, all kinds of other different groups. But for me, they're the ones that were like, I'm going to keep my eye on them. See, they're the ones that he could lose the easiest.
It's fascinating, too, that the idea persists that Trump was only appealing to blue-collar or less educated voters. Yeah. And, I mean, he won, you know, with voters in households over $50,000, which, you know, and again, I mean, if you're in a two-income household, even, you know, regardless of the job, you're going to be making more than 50 grand. But it's not like he is,
right.
you know, he's only going by with guys who are collecting, you know, who are sweeping up the union hall
right.
somewhere.
You
quote Ron Brownstein, a veteran D.C. journalist who's written for the Los Angeles Times and for The Atlantic and other places. He has said that in the long run, the Republicans have a demographic problem and the Republicans have a demographic problem and the Democrats have a geographic problem. What does that mean? And do you think he is generally accurate or not?
Brownstein had everything right leading up to the election. And the one sentence that people always forget that he said, you know, when he said, this is who needs to show up for Hillary and she's going to win. He said at the end, and just enough of white working class and suburban voters.
Mm-hmm.
And people sort of forgot that he said that. You know, they focused on youth. They focused on educated. They focused on minorities. But they forgot about this voter. I sometimes struggle with the notion that demographics is destiny.
Mm-hmm.
I think Ron is right about a lot of things. And I think he's in particularly correct in that the most vulnerable Trump voter is probably suburban women. But I'm not convinced in 2018, I've been saying this consistently, I'm not convinced that there's a blue wave, not because there's not that natural backlash to a party in power, but more so because of I want to wait and see who Democrats pick in their primaries. So they did a great job of Connor Lamb, who lives in my district. But Connor Lamb wasn't picked in a primary. He was handpicked. And, you know, he fit the district and it was perfect. But then you look at the results, the primary results in my state, in some of these congressional races where they could have easily walked to victory and now will probably not win in some of these new redrawn districts. And also take a look at Georgia. I don't believe that it was smart of Stacey. I believe Stacey Evans is the one that won to say that we don't need any Trump voters. You know, a coalition, mm-hmm. a winning coalition is always made up of a variety of different people.
So
I was just going to say, before this election, people always said
There's no such thing as a swing voter. I would argue there were a lot of swing voters in that last.
Right. So the idea is that, you know, the Republicans, seem to have a demographic problem in that their vote is overwhelmingly white and, you know, white and old, and old people die and white people are becoming less white. The Democrats, though, and this seems to be borne out in your book in particular, the geographic problem is that they are so deeply concentrated in a few areas, so they could rack up millions more votes than a Republican candidate. But if you're not hitting, you know, all 50 states, you're kind of screwed. I guess this is a question to kind of bring us to a close of this conversation. You know, given that, is Trump's populism, his ability to connect on economic issues with people who feel like their concerns are not being taken seriously by elites and by establishments, can that populism outlive him? Or is it, you know, and then what has to happen next for it to continue?
So if you're looking at a mountain, if you're looking at Mount Everest, we're pretty much at base camp. If the top of Everest is the peak of populism, I believe that this goes on long beyond him. And I believe that there are other frontiers that this populism will impact outside of politics. Before Roseanne decided to, destroy her life and all the people that work for her, one of the things that I thought was fascinating was that her show, not her, because I wouldn't even let my kids watch her when they were little, but her show authentically captured the Trump voter and the Trump voter family, in that there was conflict and that she portrayed them authentically, not sympathetically. You saw, I think the meat of that story, Nick, is in the demographics. What media markets placed at number one? Well, typically any number one show has New York and Los Angeles in the top three. That was not the case with Roseanne. That was it was Tulsa, Oklahoma, Cincinnati, Ohio, and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, my hometown. Mm-hmm. And it tells you that this coalition is impacting far beyond politics. They wanted to see something that they didn't make fun of them. I would argue the same thing with corporate America. Well, the NFL is another perfect example. You know, it was the gold standard of American businesses. Now it has fallen to Brad has those numbers. To a level that has, you know, they've fallen off their top perch, where they get their biggest sort of approval ratings come from are people with a postgraduate degree.
Right.
Well, the last time I checked, that's why, you know, so I see that impact. I see that impact in sporting goods and all of these companies that decide to pick a side in politics. Yeah. And I think people have reached that point. That's what the populism is. People in these super zip codes that are making the decisions. You know, corporate America doesn't live in the same town where their factory is anymore. You know, when I was a kid, Hoover vacuum cleaners, the Hoover family lived in the same town. They went to the same church. Their kids went to the same school. They understood when they were making their product. They understood it when they were marketing their product. And I think that is where you will see, again, that pushback against all things big.
Right. Well, we'll leave it there. I mean, it's fascinating to think about, oftentimes kind of decentralization of power and authority and economic kind of activity is seen as something that elites talk a lot about. Certainly a lot of libertarians talk about that as a good thing. And essentially what you're saying is that in politics and culture and in economics, that decentralization may actually empower populism. Rather than, kind of cosmopolitanism. Yeah. Fascinating.
Think about how weak both political parties are right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
They're
they have no core identity and they're leaking voters. I mean, independent voters are growing and the parties are shrinking. We will leave it there. We've been talking with Selena Zito. of she's the co-author with Brad Todd of The Great Revolt Inside the Populist Coalition Reshaping American Politics. Selena, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thanks so much for having me.
This has been the Reason Podcast, and I've been your host and hope to continue being Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there.